For years now, the most common headlines concerning young Americans and organized religion have been, they're going their separate ways. Statistically, that is certainly true for a growing percentage of us, leading in particular to a sharp rise in the number of self-identified nuns, people of no particular religious affiliation. That trend has certainly been dominated by Americans age 30 and younger. But there is much more to the development and maturing of religious faith that is not reflected in those raw numbers. For the past 10 years, the National Study of Youth and Religion has been examining the religious and spiritual lives of American teenagers and is now wrapping up with the publication of a fourth and final book of finding and analysis titled Back Pocket God, Religion and Spirituality in the Lives of Emerging Adults. And joining me now are the authors Melinda Lundquist Denton and Richard Florey. Welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Tell us about the title, Back Pocket God.
The title, as you probably know, book titles change over time as you're working on them. And that actually came out of the findings that that more and more young people, that's how they think about religion. They got God in their back pocket. He's not a big part of their lives. If they want him, they can access him, but they don't really want him that much. And it's not really that relevant. It's kind of like we liken it to kind of an app on your smartphone. You can use it, you can control it, you can turn it on, you can turn it off, but it doesn't really have that much to do with your life until you need it. So that's really where that comes from. And it comes out of all the survey work and the interviews that we did with the young people.
Well, how long has each of you been involved in the National Study of Youth and Religion?
So I was one of the original research assistants on the project. I worked with Christian Smith, was the original PI, and I was a graduate student of his at the time. And so he and I worked together to write the grant that initially got funding for the project back in the early 2000s. And then when the project was funded and we started the interview process, Richard was one of the interviewers that we brought on to help us collect the data. And so he and I have both been part of this project from the very beginning.
I came on after the project started, but right at the very beginning in the first wave of interviews. So I didn't do any of the survey work in any of the waves, but I interviewed young people starting when they were teenagers for each of the four waves across the 10 years, which actually I think so there are several of us on the project like that. And I think that's a bit of a strength of it, that there are some young people we saw grow up and from when they're 14, 15 years old into their mid to late 20s.
Mm-hmm. How many participants, how were they recruited? How often did you follow up with the same individuals? All of those kinds of things.
The project started in 2001, and we interviewed teenagers between the ages of 13 and 17. So that was the criteria. It was a nationally representative sample. So it was nationally representative of all households that had teenagers in them. And we interviewed one teenager and one of their parents over the telephone. There were 3,370 teenagers in our original sample and equal number of parents. So it was a large survey data set. And then the next step of the project, which is where Richard joined us, was that we took 275 to do face-to-face interviews. So there was a team of 17 interviewers, and we flew all over the country. We interviewed people in 48 states. And we went to coffee shops and libraries and parks and restaurants and sat for upwards of 2 hours and just heard what they had to say. And some of the questions were direct follow-ups from the survey. Some were extensions of that. The strength of this project was that we were able then to match their survey responses with what they told us in person. And it gave a real nuance to the data that we have. And I think throughout the project, that's been a real strength. So we did that when they were 13 to 17. We kept track of them. We sent them birthday cards. We had them, you know, give us their change of address. We talked to them again. That was in 2002 and 2003. We talked to them again in 2005 when they were between the ages of 16 and 21. We went back again in 2008 when they were between the ages of 23 and 25. And then this final time that Rich and I are writing about was the data was collected in 2013 when they were between the ages of 25 and 28. And the same model, we did a quantitative survey, and then we followed up with in-person interviews. And the interviews were with essentially the same, some came and went in their participation, but the same sure. people. So like Richard said, there's young people that I, you know, interviewed every few years for 10 years and really watched them develop. And that, I think, was a really, really strong piece of this project.
This is such a long-term project. What are the biggest changes that you can identify across the years?
The interesting thing is the survey is and the interview schedules were very wide-ranging. So we asked about every aspect of their life. And so our book is more an overview. Be some more specialized pieces that come out of it. So it's kind of, so on that level, it's a little bit hard to answer that question, which is really about religious change and contextualizing that in the rest of their lives. I think the thing that struck me the most was the pretty much routineness or irrelevance of religion in most every young person's life, except for the very few that were really highly religiously motivated.
So it wasn't decline with a vengeance so much as it was just departing.
And we talk about it as more like drifting. I mean, especially in the first wave, we were really looking to answer this question of whether there was resentment toward religion or antagonism toward religion. We heard very, very little of that. More as they got older, but even still, the major, we still go back to the quotes of one of our interviewers, Kenda Creasy Dean, who termed it as just benign, positive regard, that they were fine with religion. They have no issues with it necessarily. It just didn't hold sway for them in the way that older generations might have expected it to. And so there wasn't outright antagonism. There wasn't sort of this decisive, walking out the door and slamming it behind me. They just mm-hmm. drifted away from the table.
That's even true. I mean, it's interesting. That's even true with those that are self-identified atheists. It's like, they're not, it's just for them personally, they don't have a use for it. They're not, they would say in our interviews, it's fine for, other people. And I understand that the good of it, but it's not for me. And, mm-hmm. they would separate themselves from that angry stereotype of an atheist, and say, no, I just don't believe it, but it's okay for other people.
What do you think are the most common misconceptions about mm-hmm. young people in religion in this country?
I think that's one of them. I think the idea that they're very antagonistic toward religion, that they're sort of, making this a clear decision. For many of them, it wasn't a decision. They didn't sit down one day and decide whether they were going to be religious. Life just had a way of, pulling at their demands and their attention, and religion didn't hold a compelling place in that narrative. So I think that's one, is that there's this really anti-religion feel among young people, which we didn't hear.
Uh-huh. Right. And I think another is that most people we talked to throughout, as we were working on the book, would ask us at some point in a conversation that, they'll come back when they get married and have children. And we don't think that's going to happen. And there's specific reasons for that are detailed in a chapter on family. But we just don't see that really happening, at least in the numbers that the people that think that might happen.
Yeah. As I understand it, in addition to some young people turning away from religion in principle, there are many others who are open to and even hungry for religious community and practice, but are not able to connect with what they're finding out there. Talk about that, if you would.
I do think there are some who are open to it. And we talked about this in earlier waves of the project as well, that there is this sense of them wanting to own it and needing to see that connect with their real life. And these are anecdotal experiences, but we talked about a boy in our second book named Michael, who was raised Catholic and actually really wanted to hold on to his Catholicism, but he couldn't make it match with the questions he had about faith and his doubts. And the struggle for him was that there wasn't anyone in his life who was willing to engage his doubt. His doubt was scary for his mother. She got, anytime he raised questions, she would get upset. And so one of the things we talked about is that they needed people who were willing to engage in the hard questions and a religion that could sort of relate to all the areas of their lives. And that was one thing that I think they didn't see how religion was relevant for the things they were struggling with as young people. And so I do think we identified at that time, you know, there was an opportunity for religious groups to meet them where they are and engage them with the questions they have, even if those questions raise theological discomfort. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things we've noticed among our sample.
You know, fundamentalist denominations will be the first to claim that it is only their expression of faith and worship that is growing in this country, and that mainline churches, as well as radically inclusive progressive religious groups, are seeing dwindling numbers in support and attendance. But it's not rigid dogma and authoritarianism that the young people you write about seem to be looking for.
No, I think if you look at the numbers in our book, you'll see that our category is conservative Protestants, which would include the most conservative to broadly evangelical and probably Pentecostal in there as well. But they've lost, I think it's, Melinda, correct me on this, of those who we could identify as conservative Protestant when they were teenagers, by the time they're in their age 23 to 28, which is in our book, 25% of them are now not religious. So that's a quarter. That kind of raises questions about the claim that these churches what the churches offer to young people or to anybody often is framed as theological, you know, boundary marking and things like that, which is important. But I think as a part of that, too, Melinda and I would argue as sociologists that it offers a certain sort of community and belonging and all those kinds of important things that other groups can offer, too. But somehow they manage to do that. But I just don't agree with that. There's actually some books that are coming out now that from more evangelical authors that are making the argument that these are people that really weren't Christians in the first place. And so they're leaving, and we're separating the wheat from the chaff. I'm like, well, at some point you're going to have very little wheat and a lot of chaff if it keeps at this sort of rate. You know, 25% loss in 10 years is pretty significant.
Yeah.
I think the other thing I would say to that is that we consistently heard from the young people in our study, religion to dogma. They were very, there was this sort of like, I'm religious, but I'm not too religious. I'm not one of those extreme religious people. And there was an aversion to the extreme versions of religion in any form, including, you know, conservative, fundamentalists or Protestant. So this idea that religion is okay as long as it doesn't while it is true, I mean, the argument of the growth of strict churches we've seen play out sociologically for this generation, I think there's a real aversion to anything that sort of sounds like you might be, you know, trying to exert undue authority over my life. And that's a problem.
Sure. Yeah. Melinda, I appreciate you referring to one specific person. There are many personal narratives I know from the study subjects that are included in the book. I'd like for you, if you would, each of you, take a minute and highlight one of your favorite stories coming from this and why it stayed with you.
Well, for me, I mean, There's a lot, and as you read the interview transcripts, well, there's two things. Read the interview transcripts of the people you didn't interview. You're like, oh, I would have loved to interview that person. But for me, my response would be from a man that I interviewed four times, and we opened the book with him, and we call him Michael in the book, and it's a really interesting story, and incredibly nice and polite young man from when I first met him when he was 14 years old. I interviewed him in a back room of a library. And then over the years, we met at different places. And for the last two waves, we met at that same Starbucks to interview. And from wave one, his family was becoming more involved in church, and it was an important part of their life. And a lot of it was through his mother's mother, so his grandmother. And then over the years, you could see his life pattern is, well, I mean, none of these match exactly what the findings are, but it's kind of mirrors what we saw among a lot of these young people, which is there was involvement. There was heavy involvement at one point. I think they called him the preacher's pet at one point because he spent so much time at church, and then some disillusionment. And then finally, you know, religion is just a shill for other sort of economic interests to control people. And he says he's not religious. The interesting thing is that when I ask him, you know, we ask about spirituality, do you have any spirituality? Do you have any remainders of God? He goes, I really don't want to be religious, but it's just that every once in a while I just feel these things, and I know it's because of how I grew up. So it's really interesting to watch that in him. I would love to see him at some point in the future and see where he is.
For me, the woman that always stands out in my mind is a woman named Ashley, who we talk about in the book in the family chapter. And she's someone who I met as a struggling teenager trying to figure out her identity. She was experimenting with, she had always been a good Nazarene church, and yet she struggled with never feeling like she quite fit in at church. She had a deep faith, but she had more of an alternative. By the second time I interviewed her, she was, you know, dressing more alternative. She had more sort of edgy friends, and that didn't play well at her conservative church. And so she really struggled to find friends there. And for her, it was never an issue of whether she believed in God or whether her own faith. She just didn't fit in with the culture of her church. And so that was something I watched her struggle with in those first couple waves. And eventually she left her parents' church to go join a different church with her parents' support to find a youth group that was more open to her sort of outside the box personality. But over time, she sort of drifted from that. When I talked to her the last time in this fourth wave, she had ended up, she'd suffered from depression. She didn't feel a lot of support from her church and had sort of drifted away. Again, no animosity. She still had deep faith and really wanted to be part of a religious community, just didn't feel like she fit in there. So we talked about this, what Richard says about, are they coming back to religion when they get married? So here's a young woman who is now married. She's doing really well. She's overcome her depression. She's headed back to graduate school. She's really positive about life. And I was very encouraged to see how much she'd grown up. And in the meantime, she'd gotten married. And she had gotten married to somebody who's not religious at all. So when we started talking about what will happen when you have children, and she says, well, I really want my children to be raised in the church. I want to go back to church. But it just didn't seem to fit with the life she had crafted for herself, which was being married to somebody who's not religious, who's supportive, but not particularly interested. And so, you know, we talked about whether she would ever become, you know, religious as she grew up. And it was something that she clearly wanted, but didn't know how to do. She didn't feel like the church she was raised in was really an open door for her anymore. She didn't have a partner who was going to help her figure this out. And I left that interview feeling like it was somebody who had a desire for faith, but just couldn't quite figure out how it fit in her life or how to get back to where she had been. And so that for me is the sort of, when we talk about, are they coming back to religion? And you'll hear me say sometimes like, there has to be a tie. There has to be a bridge back. And she's someone who, while she may want to rekindle that faith, has sort of stepped away from those bridges. And I think it'll be challenging for her to reengage.
At Interfaith Alliance, our work has always been about bringing together people of various faiths and of no faith around the belief that religion has the potential for good in our nation and our world. I wonder if you see areas of common ground among young people of faith and of no faith, or is this a division that's going to be harder for the younger generation to bridge than it has been in the past?
On the one hand, they're totally fine with whatever other people believe. But that tends to not be the focus of the kinds of interactions and relationships they develop. And so to the extent that they may have, if they're Christian, they may have a Muslim friend or a Jewish friend or a Hindu friend or however that works out. Those conversations, while it looks like that happens on the surveys, when you talk to them in the interviews, they're not really talking about religion. They know what the other person believes. It doesn't come up because they get around, they come together around other kinds of issues. It's hard to know, but my guess is that's just not a priority for them in terms of figuring out interfaith dialogue. At the same time, when you ask them, do you think, religious institutions have a good, I can't remember the exact question, but you ask them about their role in society, and they almost uniformly say, churches and whatever do good things in the world. I just am not a part of it,
That said, I think while those conversations aren't happening organically, they're not opposed to them. I think one of the things that came out is that they're very open to this idea that everyone should be free to believe what they believe.
Right.
And that there's, there shouldn't be judgment of other people's beliefs. And so that I think would form a basis or a common ground for those conversations to happen if they were invited to those conversations. They're not happening organically at this point, but I don't think they're closed off to this idea of interfaith or acceptance of other people's faith.
Right. There's a section in the conclusion that we identify through all the interviews and the survey stuff, seven kinds of characteristics that we kind of frame as a generally spiritual perspective of young people, excluding any specific religion, and that across all the different kinds of ranges of commitment or not commitment to religious belief. And a colleague of mine in the center where I am calls that the goo, the stuff from which these kinds of conversations, these kinds of more public or social activities can come. And it's a common thread. They're open to other beliefs. They think anybody should believe whatever they feel compelled to believe. Don't hurt other people. Those kinds of things. That, in my view, if that actually works itself out into some sort of public ethic, then that works well. But we'll see if that's really how this works.
I am way over time, but I only have 20 questions left. But I got to ask you one, if you'll be succinct in answering, what's the most important thing you wish faith leaders would take away from this comprehensive research to help them serve young people of faith, in this country?
I would say actually listen to them. Don't give them a program. Just listen to them.
Yeah. I think in a similar vein, meeting them where they are and recognizing how the religion that we hold dear can speak into their lives and relate to their lives rather than asking them to shape their lives around, to fit into the religion that we have.
Dr. Melinda Lundquist-Denton was Wave 1 Project Manager for the National Study of Youth and Religion and is Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Texas in San Antonio. She co-authored all four of the books published during the course of this long-term study dating back to 2005. Dr. Richard Florey is Senior Director of Research and Evaluation at the USC Center for Religion and Civic Culture. His past books include The Rise of Network Christianity, how independent leaders are changing the religious landscape. The final book generated by the study's findings is titled Back Pocket God, Religion and Spirituality in the Lives of Emerging Adults. Melinda, Richard, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having us.